This is Crime Binge.
Welcome to Crime Binge,
the podcast.
And this week we're on episode 55, where we're covering Herbert Mullen,
another serial killer. Yes. And to tell you a little bit about him, he was an American serial killer who battled with mental illnesses after going through a tragedy at 18 years old. He became obsessed with reincarnation, religion, and natural disasters, and believed that killing people would prevent earth-altering earthquakes.
Yeah, which is some real strange stuff.
Yeah, like, this case is crazy.
Which we will get into in depth later on. But before we do all of that, what is your binge this week, Sarah?
So this week, I'm jumping on the bandwagon and binging what everyone in the world is binging right now.
Yeah.
And that's Avatar: The Last Airbender.
It's, you know what? It's okay.
It is.
We welcome you into the bandwagon, Sarah. Everyone welcomes you. And if they don't, then they're not a true Avatar fan.
Exactly.
You know?
And I mean, I don't know if there are any, but the people who don't know,
yes,
what Avatar is, just a little a little thing.
Yeah.
So the world is divided into four nations.
Yeah.
The Water Tribe, the Earth Kingdom, the Fire Nation, and the Air Nomads. And they all have benders which can control and manipulate the element from their nation. And the Avatar is the master of all four elements. And the Fire Nation wants to conquer the world, but only the Avatar has enough power to stop it. And they find Aang, who is the new Avatar.
Yeah.
But he's a child, and he's got to learn how to conquer all four elements so he can beat the Fire Nation.
I want to say that I think this was my first ever couple that I shipped.
Yeah.
Was on Avatar: The Last Airbender with Aang and Katara.
Yeah.
What kind of bender would you be, Sarah?
I love waterbending.
Yeah.
Like, it's so cool, and you can freeze people.
Yeah.
And do water stuff. And
I would be an earthbender because earthbenders are super cool.
Yeah.
But in reality, I'm a firebender.
I know. But yeah, it just got put on Netflix real recently. There are three seasons. I'm still on season one, but yeah. I, like, you know, I'm getting into it because, you know, they're only 20-minute long episodes.
Yeah.
And I learned that the whole show is a series. Has a 100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That is amazing. I had no idea.
It's honestly the perfect show. And, like, you learn so much stuff. It's great for kids, like, and adults, because it, like, it battles, like, sexism and,
yeah,
like, sticking up for yourself and,
yeah,
like, all this shit. And then at the end of the day, you just calm down and drink a cup of tea.
Yeah, exactly. With Uncle Iroh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the show. It's just like one of those calming, relaxing shows. And also because it is a children's show, it's like the action is never ending in every episode.
Yeah.
It's just constantly going. It's fantastic. It was also going to be my binge this week because I love it deeply. That's why my cat is named Azula, mm-hmm, even though Azula's a real bitch, but my cat's okay. Also kind of a bitch, so it fits. But I was like, nah, I'm not gonna have the same binge, but it is a fantastic show and I commend you for having that as your binge.
Thank you. It's your second honorary binge.
It is my honorary. It's always my honorary binge, let's be honest.
Also, I learned that the girl who voiced Katara,
yeah,
is Mae Whitman, and she's a great actress. Like, I love her. She's from a bunch of shit.
Yeah.
Like The Perks of Being a Wallflower. But she also recently stars in a new show called Good Girls.
Oh, okay.
And she's just a great actress and I, yeah, fucking love her. And I was like, oh,
there's a
sense.
Couple of good people who did voice acting. Mark Hamill did a voice in the show. So
yeah,
there's like some pretty sick actors in the show.
Hell yeah.
But
what, yeah, is your binge?
Oh, my binge is lame in comparison because Avatar's so great. But my binge this week is the YouTube channel Skincare by Hyram.
Okay.
And it is because I like have always had bad skin pretty much since I hit puberty. So it's been like my goal in life to make my skin better. And honestly, my skin is thriving currently. I just want to say. And it's mostly because all I do is watch skincare videos on the internet. And I think I found him like around December. Just like kept getting recommended his videos. And finally, one day I clicked them. Mm-hmm. And it's this guy who lives in Hawaii who like just reviews skincare. He goes in depth about it, about like why it's not good for your skin or why it's overpriced and you could buy something cheaper that does the same thing. Like he does it by ingredients and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he also will like watch people's skincare routines and talk about them.
Kind of like Brad Mondo.
Yeah, but he doesn't do it in like a mean way. He does it in like a really nice way. And it'll be like, okay, so I don't like that product. Here's why. And here's what I would recommend for their skin. And like, it's just really sweet. He's just a really nice guy. He's very like uplifting. And he's just like, it's a fun, his videos are kind of repetitive because he's like, fragrance is bad for your skin.
Yeah.
And like stuff like that. But it's true. So I don't mind listening to him say it. And he even talks about it. He's like, y'all have heard me say it 1,000 times. But he also will like suggest things that are safer for the environment and mm-hmm. stuff. Like a lot of the sunscreen we use is really bad for reefs and it kills the coral reefs.
Oh, wow.
coral reefs. And he like suggests ones that are safe that if they run off in the water, don't kill the reefs and things like that. So it's just, I like his videos. They're nice to watch.
That's cool.
All right, let's stop talking about my congested skin and get into today's episode.
That was the best sentence.
The best segue ever.
Yes.
So, let's get into the life of Herbert Mullen.
The insane life of Herbert Mullen?
Yes. So, Herbert William Mullen was born April 18th, 1947. And this was actually the 41st anniversary of the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. So earthquakes have been with him since his day of birth.
Yeah, and it's a significant thing for him.
Yeah. He was born in Salinas, California, but moved to a small farming community in San Francisco when he was 5. His father, Martin William or Bill Mullen, was a World War II hero who worked as a furniture salesman. He taught Herbert how to use a gun and often spoke of his time in the war. It was said that his father was very strict, but not abusive. He was described as a very good father and would spend the weekends playing with his children. That was like my parents. They were strict, but like I could handle it, you know?
Yeah.
His mother was Jean Claire Baker, who was an extremely religious woman. She was Roman Catholic and was even described as oppressively religious by the father, which is never a good time. But she was a good mother and loved her children. Like, that's how everyone described her as well. And he also had an older sister named Patricia. Herbert was described as a very bright and sensitive boy. And Herbert and his sister, Patricia, attended a private Catholic school, and Herbert was an altar boy there. So they were just very Catholic growing up.
Which I mean, like, you know, it was the 50s.
Yeah, very common. When he was 16, his family moved again to Felton, California, which is in Santa Cruz County. He enrolled in San Lorenzo Valley High School, where he had a lot of friends, he played football, and had a steady girlfriend named Loretta. In high school, he was described as being athletic, fit, very handsome, and always helpful and polite to others. Upon graduating high school, he was voted as most likely to succeed. In the summer, though, after graduating, tragedy struck Herbert when he was 18. His best friend, Dean Richardson, was killed in a car accident. This death deeply affected Herbert, and he even proceeded to build a shrine in his room dedicated to Dean, which is not a healthy coping mechanism.
Yeah.
He moved furniture around and displayed a photo of Dean, along with trinkets and old toys. He would spend hours alone in his room grieving, and he became obsessed with the idea of reincarnation, different religions, and natural disasters.
And I did read that, like, even going into as an adult, moving in and out, he, like, the shrine never went away. It stayed in his room.
Interesting. Yeah, this is, like, the beginning of his obsessive behavior, pretty much. And this event is thought to have been the catalyst to Herbert's deteriorating mental state, which it seems very likely because all events lead to that.
Exactly. After high school, he enrolled in the Cabrillo College to study engineering. In the spring of 1966, Herbert ran into one of Dean's friends, Jim Janera. They talked about Dean for a bit, as well as the anti-war movement, and Jim gave Herbert his first bit of marijuana.
Which, crazy.
I know. Later on, Herbert claims damaged his brain, and, quote, if Janera had given me some Benzedrine instead, I would have become an artist. So he blames Jim.
Yeah, just because of the marijuana.
Mm-hmm. At 19, Herbert finished his first year in college and got a summer job with a road crew, and he temporarily broke up with Loretta for 6 months.
During that time period? Mm-hmm.
In October of 1966, he had his first experience with LSD and soon became a regular user. In January of the next year, Herbert and Loretta got back together, and they soon became engaged with the thought of just settling down and starting a family.
Yeah.
In the summer of 1967, Herbert graduated with a 2-year degree in road engineering and enrolled in the San Jose State College. This year, he became an activist against the war in Vietnam and changed his major to philosophy. He became more interested in Eastern religions and took on more of a hippie lifestyle.
Starting to, like, get away from his parents and, like, do the college thing.
Yeah, and it's now, like, the late 60s. It's the flower child movement. Yeah. Everyone's doing it.
Everyone's a hippie.
Yes. Later in the year, he withdrew from college and registered as a conscientious objector, refusing any sort of draft into the war. And this shocked his father, who was a war hero.
Yeah.
He began alienating his fiance after his serious use of LSD, and his bizarre ramblings about earthquakes started to make her uneasy. He also started becoming violent, and he soon broke off his engagement with Loretta, claiming that he may be homosexual.
Okay.
And then, just kind of a fun fact, he had a tattoo on his stomach that read, "Legalize acid," according to a source, like, after his serious use with LSD.
Yeah. I think he does, because he has a series of strange tattoos that we'll talk about later.
Yeah. Shortly after this, Herbert was arrested for possession of marijuana, but pleaded down to a lesser offense and was given probation. And after this, he got a job at Goodwill Industries as a manager. Only a few months later, he quit his job, saying that he wanted to go to India to study yoga. Instead, he moved into a trailer in Sebastopol, California, on the ranch owned by his sister Patricia and her husband Albert Boca.
So, Herbert's behaviors kept escalating from weird to just alarming. At a family dinner with Patricia and Albert in the spring of 1969, Herbert began mimicking every word and gesture of Albert. This is called echolalia and echophraxia, which are symptoms of schizophrenia. Patricia later described this, saying, "When my husband would eat, Herb would eat. Whatever my husband would do, Herb would do. And that went on for 4 hours. Then he just sat and stared at us." He later asked his sister to have sex with him, And when she declined, he looked at her husband and asked him, who also declined, yeah, because that's weird. And the next day, his family took him to Mendocino Mental Hospital, where he voluntarily committed himself. He stayed here for 6 weeks, where he was diagnosed as having schizophrenia aggravated by drug use and was treated with antipsychotic medication. On May 9th, 1969, Herbert checked himself out of the mental hospital, and he was being uncooperative in his treatment, and his prognosis was labeled as poor at the time. Upon leaving the mental facility, Herbert moved to Lake Tahoe with another just-released patient. He found a job as a dishwasher at a casino, but shortly quit and returned to Santa Cruz. While in Santa Cruz, a ranger found him sitting on the ground cross-legged in a trance-like state as if he was meditating. The ranger asked Herbert to leave, and he continued staring straight ahead, but slowly began reaching for a hunting knife sitting on the ground next to him. The ranger caught him before he had a chance to grab the knife and use it, and took him to jail. Herbert was soon released and was never booked for this.
Which is kind of weird.
It is kind of weird, but maybe they thought he was, like, because of the trance-like state, they were like, he was just being weird in general, let's just get him out of here. Yeah. Probably didn't want to deal with it. Herbert also had a male roommate at the time, who he told that he was receiving messages that told him to do things. He began ritualistically burning his penis with a cigarette after meditating. Stuff to do with your genitalia, like hurting it, just freaks me out. Like, oh, yeah. It just sounds so painful. He also made an aggressive pass at a friend whose uncle was a psychiatric doctor. And Herbert was again committed to a psychiatric hospital in October of 1969. And he was committed because they claimed, as a result of a mental disorder, said person is a danger to others, a danger to himself, and gravely disabled. But was discharged on November 23rd.
So Herbert was in and out of mental hospitals and drug rehabs constantly, but rarely attended his group therapies and was inconsistent with taking his medication.
Yeah.
At one point, he was introduced to a religious commune, but he made the members uneasy. And he would, like, speak about Satan and all this stuff, and they were like,
Yeah. Probably just rambling about stuff. Yeah.
One of the members, an older woman named Pat Brown, flew to Hawaii with Herbert in the summer of 1970. Within days of being in Hawaii, he was back in a mental hospital. And he actually left the premises one time wearing a hospital gown, just out to look for a job.
Yeah.
He was examined by a psychiatrist there and was diagnosed with schizoaffective schizophrenia. He wrote to his parents to send him money to fly him back home, and they brought him home.
Yeah.
By the time Herbert was 23, he was diagnosed with having schizophrenia by 3 different doctors.
So he was very mentally ill, and yes, he just, like, needed to probably be in a facility for a little while to...
Exactly.
You know, like, an extended treatment instead of just a month here and there and stuff like that.
That could have changed this whole story.
Really could have, but here we are.
On July 30th, 1970... Herbert was arrested for being under the influence of drugs and alcohol. While he was in jail, he was not given any of his medications, and because of this, he became hyperactive and started singing in his cell very loudly.
Yeah.
He was committed to the county hospital psychiatric ward as an emergency case. The charges were dropped against Herbert, and the hospital had to release him because of a California law, similar to the Florida law, that states they can't hold an involuntary mental patient longer than 72 hours.
Right.
When he got out, he reapplied to college to study psychology, but didn't get in due to not attending his counseling appointment. He also started blaming his parents for his mental illnesses, and he changed his life insurance policy so that UNICEF would be the beneficiary instead of his parents.
Interesting.
Yeah. When he was 23, he also started going through a series of strange fads. He shaved his head, went on a macrobiotic diet, causing him to rapidly lose weight, and at one point wore a big black sombrero and faked a Mexican accent.
So very cool.
Yeah, like, it sounds like he's just trying to, like, find his identity or something.
Yeah, he's just going through it.
At one point, he also spent 10 days in jail for public intoxication and resisting arrest. And in April of 1971, his case was closed at the Santa Cruz Mental Hospital after he, again, failed to keep his appointments.
Yeah. And, like, this man does horrible things later, don't get me wrong. But it is sad that, like, because it was the 70s and no one really took mental health that seriously, like,
yeah,
it was just like, he has schizophrenia.
Oh, well.
Yeah, and, like, just keep tossing him around and he's just going to keep, like, going on from place to place. Like, it's just, it's sad. So, in May of 1971, when Herbert was 24 years old, he moved to San Francisco, which he lived there before, right? Mm-hmm. So, he's going back and forth. And when he lived there, he lived in many shitty apartments with different roommates that ranged from drug addicts to other mental patients. While in these apartments, he met a new friend named Alan Hansen, who confirmed his beliefs on reincarnation and convinced him that the voices he was hearing in his head was actually telepathy, indicating that he was chosen by God to do something special. In September, he got a gym membership and started doing some amateur boxing, which would probably be good for him, honestly. Yeah. He was apparently pretty good, but obviously did strange things while he was there. He would punch the speed punching bag until his hands were covered in blood, and if his trainer left him alone, he would stand still and start loudly just talking to himself. He received a permit to box in the Golden Gloves competition in March of 1972. However, he had to be pulled away from his opponent after he would not stop hitting him after he was down, which is a big no-no.
Yeah.
He was also evicted from the apartment he was living in after this, when Herbert would continuously punch the ground and have screaming matches with God, which is loud. A screaming match with God would be very loud.
Yes.
Because of this, in September of 1972, he moved back in with his parents. He stopped taking his medication again, and he became increasingly angry with his father. The voices in his head told him that a natural disaster was coming, and to confirm this, a major earthquake was thought to hit California within the upcoming months. They're always worried about fucking earthquakes in California. Yeah.
Doesn't California get like 1,000 earthquakes a day, like small ones?
I don't know. California is constantly on the brink of breaking off from the rest of society, though. Like, the big one, it's real, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
The voices told him that in order to prevent catastrophic natural disasters like the earthquake, that humans had to be sacrificed. Herbert believed that the Vietnam War had produced enough American deaths to stall the forthcoming earthquake, but with the war winding down in late 1972, he believed that he would have to start killing people to have enough sacrifices to keep the earthquake away and save California. He also believed that he was the one for the job, as he was born on the anniversary of the San Francisco earthquake.
So, Herbert starts murdering.
Yeah.
On Friday, October 13th, so Friday the 13th,
yeah,
of 1972, Herbert found a baseball bat in the garage, put it in his car, and went for a drive. Herbert claimed that earlier in the week, his father was sending him telepathic messages telling him to kill. He said, "If I didn't kill, it would bring shame to the family by showing cowardice. It was kill or get out." As he drove his 1958 Chevy station wagon through the Redwoods on Highway 9, Herbert spotted a homeless man walking alone along the road. He passed the man and then pulled over a bit up the road and popped his hood, pretending to have car trouble.
Yeah.
When the homeless man, who was Lawrence, they called Whitey White,
I'm assuming because his last name.
Yeah. Who was 55, approached the car, he offered to help and take a look at the engine. When his head was under the hood, Herbert took the baseball bat out of his car and began beating Whitey over the head with it until he was dead.
Horrible.
Yeah, that's a graphic death.
Yeah.
Herbert then pushed Whitey's body down the side of the road and drove off. He later claimed that Whitey looked like Jonah from the Bible and was sending him telepathic messages saying, "Hey man, pick me up and throw me over the boat. Kill me so that others will be saved." Whitey's body was discovered a few days later, and since he was homeless, he had no family to mourn him, attend his funeral, or push to find his killer.
Yeah, and if he did have family, they might not have known what exactly happened to him. The voices in Herbert's head informed him that one kill was not enough to stop the earthquake. Not even 2 weeks later, on October 24th, 1972, Cabrillo College student, 24-year-old Mary Guilfoyle, was running late for an interview, so she decided to hitchhike. This was a last resort for Mary, as many women hitchhikers were going missing and showing up dead. As this was the exact time and place that Edmund Kemper, the co-ed killer, was also operating.
Yeah, and it was said that Ed Kemper lived, just blocks away from this college.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that makes sense that he would, be close to a college like that. But when Herbert Mullen pulled up alongside her to pick her up, she felt at ease with him. He was handsome, soft-spoken, and being 5'9", wasn't that much bigger than she was. While Mary was in the car, Herbert pulled off onto a quiet side street where he pulled out a hunting knife and stabbed her in the chest and in the back. She died instantly, but Herbert dragged her body into a desert area and disemboweled her. And just like a graphic warning ahead, just skip ahead if you're a little squeamish, because when I read this, I was like, yikes, I'm out of here. He scattered her insides all around from her body, hanging them on trees and bushes, and left. And her body would not be found for several months, but when it was found, it was believed to be the work of Ed Kemper because of the graphic nature of the stage crime scene.
Mm-hmm. On November 2nd, 1972, just a week later, Herbert had been drinking and stumbled into St. Mary's Catholic Church in Los Gatos. He had the idea of confessing his sins with hope to give him the strength to never attempt to kill again.
He was trying.
Yep. Was real short-lived.
Yeah.
At first, he thought that the church was empty, but then heard someone in one of the confessionals. The man in the confessional was 64-year-old Father Henry Tomei. Tomei was actually a French resistance veteran who came to America after the war ended, and he was in his eighth year as assistant pastor. Herbert confessed to his sins and murders to Father Tomei, and then afterwards forced open the door where Father Tomei was and attacked him.
Yeah.
And it's uncertain if Herbert believed that he was volunteering himself as a sacrifice or if he would go to the police and tell them what Herbert confessed.
Right.
So it's uncertain why he killed him.
Yeah.
But he beat, kicked, and then stabbed Father Tomei in the heart with his hunting knife, which killed him.
Yeah.
During the attack, a parishioner walked in and, upon seeing the struggle, screamed and ran out. She gave a description to the police of a young, tall man in black clothing and black boots. This description didn't really help the police, though, and they thought that Father Tomei was either lured into the church or was the victim of a robbery gone wrong.
Yeah.
And some members of the church thought it may be the work of a satanic cult.
Because everything was Satan's fault at this point of time.
People in the community were outraged by the murder, and many people, including civic leaders, attended his funeral. The police were also at the funeral, thinking that the killer may return to the scene of the crime to view his handiwork. They were wrong, as Herbert did not attend the funeral, but he did end up leaving some fingerprints behind.
In November, shortly after killing Father Tomei, Herbert had a change of mind. He wanted to appease his father and follow in his footsteps of joining the military. He also believed that it would be easier to provide sacrifices to the earth if he was in the military and it was his job to kill. Which is good thinking, honestly, yeah. I guess. So he applied to join the Coast Guard. In December, he was denied after failing his psychological exam. After this, his paranoia increased. He believed that it was all a conspiracy against him and that the Flower Children brainwashed him by giving him drugs and making him become a conscientious objector. Sorry.
That word is hard.
It's just so long. It looks like it never ends.
I know.
He apparently wanted to make a sacrifice and targeted one of his longtime friends and fellow drug user, John Hooper. He arrived at Hooper's house with his hunting knife, but decided against it when he learned that there were 9 other people in the house as well.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a fair fight.
No, that would not. This is when Herbert decided to purchase a gun, believing that it would be a quicker, easier way to kill people with less evidence left behind. He purchased a gun, telling the salesman that his occupation was a sketch artist, and obviously lied about his time in jail and mental hospitals. Then, in January of 1973, Herbert decided to try and join the Marine Corps this time. The recruiting officer was weary at first, but after constant badgering from Herbert, he recommended him for service. In his official report, he stated, "Herbert William Mullen is an intelligent and highly motivated young man with an ultra-zealous eagerness to enlist in the USMC. Because of Herbert's earnest desire to improve his lot and climb above his peers, as it were, I submit that Herbert William Mullen can, and most likely will, be a benefit to whatever unit he is assigned and a credit to his corps." Herbert was very excited that his application was accepted because he had been rejected from previous ones.
Yes.
So on January 15th, 1973, Herbert passed both the psychological and physical exams, but was still dismissed. There is conflicting evidence saying that he was either dismissed because he refused to sign a document that would release his arrest records, or that he was dismissed because the Marine Corps found out about his use of drugs.
Well, I mean, it could be both, but yeah, like sources said all different things.
After he was rejected by the Marine Corps, Herbert was devastated and went on long rants blaming his parents for their failures in raising him. His father was tired of hearing all of these rants and told Herbert that it was time for him to move out.
I can just imagine him just being like, "Get the fuck out of my house, boy.
You're talking so much shit. Get out of here." On January 19th, Herbert moved into a shabby apartment by himself near the beach. He spent a few days alone, thinking alongside the voices in his head, and began blaming drugs for his downfalls, which, I mean, constant LSD use probably did not help him at all.
Oh, yeah. So, this thinking of blaming drugs caused him to focus on one person, Jim Genera, his old high school friend who gave him his first taste of marijuana and told him about the anti-war effort.
He basically made him a hippie.
Exactly. And he had also purchased guns from him before.
Yeah.
So, he went to Jim's house on January 25th, 1973, and discovered that his old friend had moved away. This old cabin that was on Mystery Spot Road now housed Kathy Francis, who was 29, and her 2 sons, Damien, who was 9, and David, who was 4. You know, I'm pretty sure she also was friends with them all, like, before.
Yeah, she was friends with, I know Jim for sure, but I don't know about him.
Yeah. So she gave him Jim's new address in Santa Cruz on Western Avenue. So he drove there, and upon entering the house, he screamed, "You're clap-trapping me," and shot Jim.
Don't know what that means.
Me either, but that's what he screamed. Trying to escape, Jim climbed up the stairs to the bathroom where his wife was either taking a shower or a bath. He followed Herbert up the stairs and shot him and his wife Joan in the head. And then some sources say that he then used his hunting knife to stab both of the bodies after they were dead. And the couple was discovered later that day by Joan's mother, who was babysitting their infant girl.
Yeah, it's like there's conflicting reports of how they actually died.
Yeah.
But also, I looked up claptrapping because I had to know. And it says that a claptrap is in itself an absurd or nonsensical talk or idea. So I think he was just literally yelling about nonsense while using a word that was nonsense.
Yes.
Sorry, I just found that interesting.
You're good. So after killing this couple, he drove back to Kathy's home and murdered her by shooting her in the chest and in the head, and then went to her children's bedroom where her sons were playing on their bunk beds and stabbed her two children to death. Another source believes that Kathy was killed first after giving the information, and some say that Kathy and her children were killed afterwards, as Herbert thought she could be a potential witness after it was discovered that Jim and his wife were killed.
Yeah, again, conflicting, because yes, he says one thing and everyone else says another
thing.
And,
like, the majority of the stuff is coming from Herbert, because these victims aren't alive to give their stories.
Right.
Kathy's husband, Bob Francis, who was not home at the time, was also a drug dealer. So police originally thought that the five murders were all connected and motivated by drug trafficking. When her husband gave the police potential suspects, he did a lot of other drug dealers and stuff.
Yeah.
He did not give Herbert Mullen's name, as they had not heard from him since 1971.
Yeah. So on February 10th, Mullen was in the Henry Cowell Redwoods State Park, where he came across four teenage boys who were between the ages of 15 and 19. The boys were David Oliker, 18, Robert Spector, who was also 18, Brian Card, 19, and Mark Drabelbiss, who was 15. The teenagers were camping in the park, and technically the boys were camping there illegally. So Mullen walked over, claiming to be a ranger, and talked with the boys for a bit. And the reason that Mullen knew this was illegal is because he had basically just been told by a park ranger that he couldn't camp there. And he stumbled upon these teenage boys and thought it wasn't fair that they were camping and went up to talk to them, basically. He told them that they needed to leave because they were polluting the forest, but they refused to leave and laughed at Herbert. So he shot the boys fatally and then abandoned their bodies. Before leaving, Herbert took their rifle and the $20 they had. He would later claim, "I decided to kill them and asked them telepathically if I could, and they all answered yes. They were all in a sitting position, and it was all over in a few seconds." Their bodies were found a week later by one of the boys' brothers, which is very sad.
Mm-hmm. And I think they were, like, in the tent or something.
Yeah, they were all sitting in the tent.
Yeah, and it's, like, said that there was obvious signs of a struggle, and one of them tried to, like, rip through the tent to get out and stuff.
That's really sad.
Mm-hmm. The final murder took place just 3 days later on the morning of February 13th. Mullen was driving around looking for firewood to bring back to his parents' home. While he was driving, he said he heard a telepathic message come from his father saying, "Don't deliver a stick of wood until you kill somebody." And Herbert said that he tried to resist these thoughts, but the voices said, "Just kill somebody. Anybody."
Yeah.
So he kept driving when he eventually drove past Fred Perez, who was 72, and a retired fisherman and one-time prized fighter who was weeding his lawn at his house.
Yeah, he was just living his life.
Exactly. Just doing some lawn work.
Yeah.
So Herbert suddenly makes a U-turn, stopped his station wagon, and laid his rifle across the hood to aim and fire, killing the man instantly with a single shot to the heart at 8 a.m.
Yeah.
And this rifle was actually the rifle stolen from the campsite of the boys that he previously murdered.
Yeah.
After doing this, he just calmly got in his car and drove off. Keep in mind, it's 8 a.m. It's broad daylight, and there were a number of witnesses who called the police, one of which was Fred's next-door neighbor, who saw everything from her window and gave police a license plate number and said that the vehicle was heading in the direction of Felton. A few minutes later, Mullen was captured at the intersection of Highway 9 and Coral Street. The officer had drawn his weapon, preparing for a shootout because Mullen's rifle was clearly visible in the passenger seat, but he didn't resist the arrests at all.
Yeah, he just kind of sat there. Once in custody, Mullen was initially a very difficult person, refusing to talk or even answer routine questions like, do you have an attorney? To which he would just yell, replying, silence!
Silence!
He just kept chanting the word silence until he basically frustrated everyone enough that they just took him to his cell and were like, we'll deal with him later.
Same.
While they were taking him away, he announced, you people were responsible for the 3 million killed in World War II. And there was a doctor at the police station who did an examination because he was obviously acting a little crazy. And they found a series of strange tattoos on top of his legalized acid tattoo. He had eagle eyes, marijuana, birth, Mahashamandi, and Kriya Yoga. So he just like got random words tattooed on his body.
Yeah.
And investigators found this odd for someone who appeared so clean cut and like outwardly hated hippies.
Yeah, because they're all like drugs, yoga, Eastern religions, you know.
Just a very strange ideology for someone who now like hates hippies.
Yeah.
Investigators also began to search his sparse apartment, as he had only been living there for about 3 weeks. They found a Bible, The Life and Times by Einstein, an address book with Jim Ganera listed, and a newspaper about the recent murders. They also found the following note. Let it be known to the nations of Earth and the people that inhabit it, this document carries more power than any other written before. Such a tragedy as what has happened should not have happened, and because of this action, which I take of my own free will, I am making it possible to occur again. For while I can be made here, I must guide and protect my dynasty. He was eventually charged with 6 counts of murder, and the count rose to 10 after the bodies of the campers were discovered on February 17th. At this point, police were desperate to make arrests, as there had been so many murders in the area recently, because Ed Kemper's also killing people.
Yeah, and I think there was another one who had done it too. Like, it was like,
yeah,
I think they called it Murderville, USA.
Yeah, the 70s in California were crazy. Really, the 70s all across the US, but a lot in California.
Yeah.
And when asked why the murder rate was so high in Santa Cruz, District Attorney Peter Chang answered by saying, first, we've had a homicidal maniac whom we know has killed 10 people. And another reporter asked about the additional 5 bodies of female hitchhikers, to which he responded, we then have another homicidal maniac. So they were just like, we know we have homicidal maniacs out there. We just don't know how to catch them, basically.
We just got to get to them.
We're trying to catch them. And although police wanted to tie the deaths of the co-eds to Mullen to wrap that case up, there really wasn't any evidence to do so. The way the heads were removed was too precise to fit his motive.
And, you know, eventually fit Ed Kemper's motive.
Yeah, and Ed Kemper, like, confesses, I'm pretty sure. So he eventually confessed to his crimes, saying that he had been told by voices in his head to kill people in order to prevent an earthquake. He said that the reason there had been no earthquakes recently was due to his handiwork, according to some sources. And apparently, like, I think it was 8 days after he was arrested or something, a pretty big earthquake hit the area.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, oh, shit, I was right, basically.
Yeah, he was like, see?
He was given a public defender, James Jackson, to which Herbert denied this counsel and told the judge, I don't care to be represented by a long hair.
And I guess his hair was, like, kind of shaggy to his shoulders.
Yeah, because it was that era. Like, all men had long hair.
My dad's hair was down to his butt in the 70s.
And your dad's hair is basically still down to his butt.
You're not.
At his initial hearing, Mullen tried to plead guilty, but the judge refused this plea in a case of such magnitude. Mullen argued back, saying, you gave me a choice, and I choose. And his lawyer tried to step in, But Mullen said that he refused his counsel, like we said, and insisted on representing himself. But James Jackson actually went on to defend him after the judge refused that Herbert fire him.
Yeah, he was just like, you're not allowed to do that.
Yeah, and he said something like, basically, like, you're not allowed to just say you're guilty to all the first degree murder charges to, like, lessen your crimes or whatever. James Jackson actually went on later to also defend Ed Kemper. So he was defending serial killers around this time.
Yep.
During the trial, the defense went with the insanity defense, stating that Herbert was clearly schizophrenic, which was backed up by multiple doctors. And the prosecution brought Bob Francis and Jim Gennara's mother to the stand to testify about what they saw when finding their loved ones' bodies. The prosecution did admit that they thought that Herbert was legally insane when he committed the first three murders, but was in his right mind when committing the last 10, but stated that Herbert's LSD use probably had something to do with them.
So, Herbert also took the stand at his own trial, where he blamed his friends, family, particularly his father, and teachers, saying that they wanted to keep him from becoming too powerful in his next life. He also talked about his earthquake theory and said, "One man consenting to be murdered protects the millions of other human beings living in the cataclysmic earthquake and tidal area. For this reason, the designated hero and leader and associates have the responsibilities of getting enough people to commit suicide and or consent to being murdered every day."
Wow.
That was a sentence.
It was.
He talked about the voices that he heard in his head and referred to the messages he received from them as die songs. And I think one of his psychologists went on to write a book called Die Songs later.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they did.
When talking about his victims, he said, "I never thought about them. I wasn't thinking. I don't think. I was reacting." He claimed his victims consented to die, in fact, were willing to die, and told him so by psychic transmissions. Quote, "Every Homo sapien communicates by mental telepathy. It's just not accepted socially."
True, true, true.
Yep, that's how I communicate.
Just kidding.
He also blamed the Santa Cruz police for not keeping him incarcerated after he was arrested so many times for drug possession, saying, I never would have killed anyone if they sent me to jail. If they don't punish you for breaking the law, what were they doing? Waiting until I broke a big law so they could put me in jail all my life?"
I mean, that is kind of how it works.
Yeah, I know.
Like, that's why jail is there. So once you do the big thing, you go to it.
Mm-hmm. One doctor testified that Mullen had told him, "I chose to be vindictive because these people caused me to be an objector in the greatest country on earth, so I punished them." In closing, the defense asked the jury to consider the fact that Mullen kills people because he has to, but he doesn't know why. "I suggest that a person who kills 13 people and doesn't know why is mad."
Yeah.
The prosecution then told the jury, "There's no question he's mentally ill. Seriously, mentally ill. But that does not mean he's legally insane. He hid his crimes and even ground down the serial numbers on his gun."
Yeah.
So, like, he knew what he was doing.
Right.
The jury, consisting of 6 men and 6 women, deliberated for over 14 hours, and on August 19th, 1973, found Herbert Mullen legally sane and guilty.
Yeah.
And although this conclusion sounds insane, legally speaking, insanity is determined by the McNaughton standard, which says if a defendant understood the difference between right and wrong, then the defendant is guilty.
Which he showed by, like, filing the serial numbers on your gun and things like that.
Mm-hmm. The jury found that Herbert premeditated the murders of Jim Gennara and Kathy Francis, and convicted him of first-degree murder for their deaths. The jury considered the rest to be impulse killings and charged him with second-degree murder on those. He was sentenced to life in prison and has been denied parole 10 times since 1980, and he's apparently up for parole again this year in 2020.
Yeah.
When he was up for parole in 2006, he claimed that he just wants to come home to Santa Cruz County, live in Boulder Creek, and find a wife, and claims that he would be a hard-working, law-abiding citizen. However, he's currently imprisoned at Mule Creek State Prison in Ione, California, and is currently 73 years old.
When I was like doing some research for this, I came across some articles of when he was like up for parole in 2006 of mm-hmm. people being like, we do not want him back in Santa Cruz. Like yeah. the whole county was like losing their mind to him coming back in.
Rightfully so.
Yeah. Although we do like our fun little Florida man stories at the end to like lighten things up. I wanted to share just a little fun thing that we discovered while, like, researching this case. Mm-hmm. And this is just, let's consider it a whole oh no section.
Yes, an oh no paragraph.
Yeah, instead of an oh no fact, an oh no paragraph. So, there was a rivalry between Ed Kemper and Herbert Mullen, which is just the greatest thing I've ever heard. Yes. Serial killer rivalry.
Because they were
killing at the same time, yeah. same place. They were stepping on each other's killing toes.
Yep.
So when Ed Kemper was arrested, him and Mullen were briefly held in adjoining cells where Kemper accused him of stealing his dump sites. Like they were just being petty back and forth.
Yes.
Kemper also found Herbert very annoying and recalled saying, quote, well, Mullen had a habit of singing and bothering people when somebody tried to watch TV. So I threw water on him to shut him up. Then, when he was a good boy, I'd give him some peanuts. Herbie liked peanuts. That was effective because pretty soon he asked permission to sing. That's called behavior modification treatment.
I know you're not supposed to love a serial killer.
Yeah.
But I love Ed Kemper. He's like
just so sassy. Like, he did horrible shit. Oh, yeah. But he's just so sassy.
And he's so smart.
So, during their time in adjoining cells, Kemper was so petty that he offered to rat on Mullen if he ever heard him say anything incriminating. He was, like, going to the police like, hey, I'll talk.
Oh, yeah.
And on the other hand, Mullen found Kemper disgusting and complained about any noises that Kemper made while he was trying to meditate. And the two both viewed their killings as missions and said the other person's mission was wrong. Mullen said Kemper was brutish, and Kemper said that Mullen was a cold-blooded killer just killing to kill.
For no reason, just so killing to kill.
The two were just like complete jerk-offs and loved talking about each other, and I just thought that was funny that they had a little rivalry going on.
Yeah, it was good. I'm like, next we should have done Ed Kemper.
Yeah, I do want to eventually cover Ed Kemper because his case is so interesting.
Oh yeah, but it'll definitely be like a two-parter
at least. Yeah. So should we get into our Florida man story today?
Let's do it. Let's end on two light notes. All right, so my yes. Florida man story yes. to, you know, shout out our fellow Floridians here, is from a while ago.
That's okay.
But, you know, there has been hundreds of years of Florida man stories.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Florida man has been doing it up for a long time.
So this comes from 2016.
Okay.
And the title is Burrito Attack, Fork Stabbing Leads to Arrest of Florida Couple.
Always food-based, you know?
I love the food-based ones. So, a Florida couple was arrested Tuesday after an argument led to a woman to strike her husband in the back of the head with a burrito.
Wow.
The man, 66-year-old Carl Owen Smith, retaliated against his 51-year-old wife, Suzanne Holvert, by stabbing her hand with a fork. Suzanne told responding officers that the couple was fighting over her husband's desire to go to the bar and drink every night. During the argument, she hit him in the back of the head with her half-eaten Taco Bell Burrito Supreme. She said that he then stabbed her hand with a fork he was using to eat a Taco Bell pizza and then just left their home.
Wow.
Police added that Suzanne was relatively calm and in good spirits, but had a fork protruding from her right hand.
Yeah.
The fork fragments were removed by staff at the medical center. And responding officers also noted that bits of burrito were scattered on the floor, sofa, and a lampshade. Carl was not at the Crestview residence when police arrived, and authorities said they found him at a local bar.
Makes sense.
He was charged with aggravated battery, and Suzanne was charged with domestic violence-related battery.
Look at them go.
Ideal couple.
Taco Bell just plays such a pivotal role in so many people's relationships, you know? All right, guys. We hope that you liked this interesting serial killer this week who is hopping about at the same time as Ed Kemper.
Yeah, I had honestly never really heard much about him before.
Yeah, like I think I've heard the name in passing, but I didn't really know a ton about his case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's cool, though. It was an interesting one.
Definitely.
And we hope that you guys will join us on social media to look at all of our stuff that we share about our podcast.
You can find us at Crime Binge or Crime Binge Podcast.
Yes.
And please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you can.
Yeah.
And we would greatly appreciate it.
And we'll see you guys next week. And keep on binging. Bye.
See ya.